Kia ora and welcome back. And now it is time for our Tuesday political wrap-up with Raph Manji, who we have on the line with us. Good morning, Raph. Hello? Uh-oh, have we lost? Oh, he's here. Good morning, Raph.
I've been here all the time. Where did you go?
Yeah,
the kettle on or something?
Yeah, I must have. Sorry. How are you?
Good. I'm well, thank you.
You're in Otatahi today, I believe.
I am. I'm down here for most of the week. I've got a sort of public meeting this evening at Bishopdale Community Library, if you're around. I'm down and have a chat. And yeah, just getting around meeting people, catching up with what's going on the ground here. And yeah,
well,
always good to be back.
You've come at just the perfect time, really.
Yeah. The weather's pretty good as well.
Oh, yeah, it's just stunning. Look at all that sun. Anyway, a few things to talk about this morning. So we'll kick it straight off, basically. And as you know, has been pretty routine in the last couple of years. Lots of conversation at the moment about New Zealand's health system, how stretched it is, underfunded, not enough staff. The list goes on, really. What's kind of your perspective on the current state of our health system?
Well, I mean, there's been, you know, we've had chronic underinvestment for years, and I think the government, as it's done with a lot of things, has focused on structure, such as centralising the health system, centralising the water system, and creating these new entities, centralizing the polytechnics, creating these entities, and spending huge amounts of money on rearranging deck chairs instead of actually repairing the massive holes in the deck chairs. And I think one of the frustrations, I mean, we should acknowledge there's been this survey released, I think, yesterday by the New Zealand Women in Medicine Trust, which surveyed, I think, over 900 primary and secondary care medical professionals. And I think, I mean, the numbers were ridiculous. 93% there's a crisis in the workforce.
Wow.
98% said there are issues. And I think one of the frustrations from the medical profession, and this is all across the spectrum, anyone working either in primary or secondary care, is like, please acknowledge that there is a crisis. And there is.
Yeah.
I mean, our hospitals are at breaking point, but also our primary care is at breaking point. I mean, you know, try and get an appointment with your GP. It's sometimes taking up to 6 weeks. I mean, you know, that people are going to die because of that.
Mm.
And I think the frustration with health minister is that he just refuses to acknowledge there's a crisis. It's just, oh, well, we're sort of coping. It's like, oh, my God, yeah, people are not lying in the streets. But, you know, the system is in crisis. And I think if they'd paid more attention dealing with that over the last 5 years that they have been in government, we might not be in this position. So I think, you know, workforce recruitment and retention is a huge issue.
Mm.
And, you know, we saw some comments from the PM yesterday that didn't go down very well here or overseas when, you know, she made comments about migrant nurses or, you know, kind of not being committed to the country.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of the data doesn't support her position. And it's a bit, again, trying to blame other people for really what are the government's shortcomings. I mean, often for nurses coming in, they may not stay because there's huge restrictions on their family members coming in. I mean,
it's
a kind of attitude. I mean, it, to be fair, over the last 2 to 3 years, our reputation overseas in terms of a good place to move to work and live has gone down a lot. And we're seen as being very transactional and that people should be lucky to come here and New Zealand's an amazing place and just put up with it. And actually, people have got other choices now. You know, Australia, Canada, the UK, a lot of countries in Asia now are opening up in terms of, you know, increased migration, particularly in that care and nursing sector. And, yeah, everyone's got a bit of a shortfall. And now New Zealand is not looking like a great place. So I think the government's really got to get its act together. Obviously, pay conditions need to be improved. You know, pay parity between primary and secondary care staff, you know, and a kind of bottom-up design. And again, the government takes a top-down approach to everything and says Wellington knows best. And actually what we see is that's not the case at all. And people outside Wellington are just getting more and more frustrated. And also they just sort of feel like, yeah, they feel underappreciated. And so when the health minister keeps going, oh, well, everything's coping, you know, that just sends the wrong message. Instead of saying, look, yeah, we've got some serious problems here, and this is what the government is trying to do to fix that. Instead, they're in that sort of culture of denying there's an issue, and then sort of saying, oh, well, it's somebody else's fault.
Yeah, what should the government be doing? Is this the kind of issue that you can simply throw more money at, or is it a case of upskilling more people quicker? Like, what's really a strong solution here?
Yeah, I mean the pay issue is definitely there, and the government has resisted that. So pay parity, pay equity, those are critical issues that could be solved, and we're seeing that in a number of kind of frontline service areas. Obviously, we've seen the fire brigades also talking a lot about that, and we're just not paying people enough money. And when they see, you know, headlines about the amount consultants are being paid, and, you know, they spent $100 million on this and $100 million on this, and they're going, well, what about people actually doing the work? So that's something the government could be doing. I think one of our problems in terms of workforce preparation, and obviously the impact of COVID, is the government has just not planned enough. So we need to train more nurses. We need to train more doctors. And that may be actually opening up new medical schools or new training facilities. And there seems to have been a little bit of a closed shop approach to that. So there could be some improvements there. And yes, and we need to make it easier for overseas nurses and doctors to come in. And they may come in and they may go. And I think that is just a reality of managing any kind of health system these days. So I think, you know, definitely those are issues. So training, better incentives to keep, you know, trained professionals here, particularly the same issue we always have in terms of rural communities. I mean, you've got to pay people more. I mean, that's just the reality of it.
Yeah.
If you want to have those services, you need better incentives, better bonding, and better support. I mean, rural GPs and medical facilities are just creaking at the seams. And, you know, I guess finally the other one is just, and this is what I get from doctors, particularly pediatric doctors, is the social determinants of health issues. So they get kids coming into hospitals, they fix them up, send them home, and they know they're going to be back in 6 weeks' time. So issues around poverty, which government has not solved. And we've still got some nearly 30,000 people on, you know, public housing waiting list. You've got kids who've been living in motels for years now. And that impacts the health system. So doctors are going, well, what can we do? You know, we came into this profession to help and support people. And all we're doing is being an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. Can you please stop people falling over? So that's issues around good quality housing. Is critical, and essentially better incomes for people.
Right, well, thank you for that. Moving on, recently we've made agreements, deals, however you might call them, with both the European Union and the United Kingdom. What's your thoughts on those?
Look, I mean, these things are not always as good as they sound. EU FTA was not that exciting, and you would have probably heard the beef and lamb sector was not particularly happy, or dairy was not particularly happy with it. But the fact is, you know, the 28 countries of the European Union are never going to allow open access for products that they produce themselves.
Yeah.
And we've seen that in other countries like India. And so I guess that feedback is understandable. But, I mean, I think the government was very practical about this. I mean, we have some really good trade negotiators, and they're there regardless of who the government today is, and they're working hard. And I think there was a sense, particularly from the EU side, that we had a very small window in which to sign a deal. The EU was kind of, let's say, open, and New Zealand was there, and it's like, okay, either you sign this now or that's it. And a lot of it is the photo opportunity. And in terms of impact, yeah, export revenue to the EU, for example, might grow by $1.8 billion annually on full implementation. That's kind of over, you know, 10 to 15 years. So, you know, it's not a huge deal, but it's a good deal. And I think most people would agree that it's better to take it than not take it. You're kind of, it's better to be kind of in the tent than sort of outside the tent, even though you might be a bit squashed in the corner. And I think very much the same with the UK free trade agreement. That was probably a better deal.
Yeah,
in that it's removing tariffs from all products. though again, you know, farming is at the back of the queue. And I think the UK was desperate to do some deals, obviously following Brexit. So kind of, New Zealand is small, the numbers are tiny in terms of their overall market. So let's sign a deal, let's do the photo opportunity, let's show that we're open to business. And often these trade deals are a little bit like that. I mean, for us, you know, essentially China is still our biggest market for exports, and Australia and the US behind that. So those are our key markets, Japan, South Korea. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we want to have good relationships with the UK and the EU. And these deals, you know, they don't hurt us, add a little bit of value, and they're probably better to have than not have.
You've touched on it already, but beef and lamb's criticisms of the deal. Do you think their fear, and they are, you know, essentially a lobby group, and do we give them too much voice?
No, I mean, look, they're free to have the voice that they want. And I think, obviously, you know, export of meat has been a big part of, you know, New Zealand agriculture for a very, very long time. So, but I mean, they know this, that the competition is fierce. New Zealand products are very well regarded.
Yeah.
And we know that. So quality and value is critical. So kind of moving from volume to value is the phrase that people use. But, you know, I don't know if you ever met a French farmer, but these guys are not, you know, generally happy about people selling stuff into their market. So these are practical issues. And farming is very strong in the EU. And yes, there's a high level of protectionism and subsidy built into that. And we just have to deal with it. So I think, you know, we just have to keep going up the value curve, showing that we're the stuff that we're exporting and producing is of the highest quality. Issues like carbon neutral, how we deal with methane, you know, these are all things that we could be dealing with, which will improve the demand for our goods. So, yeah, look, I mean, I think obviously they're disappointed about it, but the reality is that, the EU was never going to move on this. And it was better just to kind of get the deal. And the same with India. You know, we spent years trying to do a free trade agreement with India around dairy, and it's never going to happen. And anyone you speak to behind the scenes in India would say, we don't know why New Zealand keep doing this. But it's, you know, you've got to go for where there are opportunities for both countries to be better off.
Mm-hmm.
And, often trade these days is as much about general diplomatic relationships as, you know, basic economic outcomes.
The deal with the United Kingdom allows for, well, eases the process for Kiwis to kind of live and work in the United Kingdom. Do you think there is risk of kind of a brain drain effect there?
Oh, look, yeah, I mean, we're going to see that anyway. I think, you know, you'll know this, I'm sure, and certainly a lot of people I hear from there, it's time for them to go overseas. They've been locked up in New Zealand for 2 years. And, yeah, the opportunities overseas seem to be a lot better than they are in New Zealand. So, yeah, I think you will see, you'll see some very strange movements over the next few years, you know, primarily for personal reasons. And, yeah, the UK is an attractive place to go. It's fun, huge market, a lot going on there, you know, politically and economically. And so, yes, I think changing the working holiday rules are good, but also that works two ways as well. So I think it's good. It's good for young people to move around, and it's good to build up skills and live in other countries.
That's
a good thing.
Now, what the British do best is, of course, political drama, and they've had plenty of that recently. Does that kind of turmoil amongst the United Kingdom government, will that, like, affect this deal at all?
No, not at all. The Conservatives are, you know, very open on those trade issues, and I think one of the big drivers around Brexit, and I think whoever takes the leadership of the Conservative Party is going to have to be, you know, strongly pro-Brexit. Is that they wanted to trade openly with the rest of the world, you know, put the great back into Britain and all that kind of stuff. So, no, it's not going to affect the relationship. I think the relationship with New Zealand will still be seen to be strong. The UK is quite keen to get more involved in the Pacific and the Indo-Pacific. Indo-Asia. So, you know, I think, no, that relationship will still be quite strong, and I don't think it will really matter who the next leader is. But I think a lot's being written about Boris, but I think essentially it shows that the public will not tolerate corruption of their systems. And I think that the trust in our governance systems is certainly being called into question. And, you know, people will certainly tolerate a lot in terms of, you know, what people get up to, but they need to trust that some basic processes are being followed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's quite critical, because we're seeing, you know, such a fall off in trust around our basic political institutions. We see what's happening in the US, and that's probably more important than, you know, whoever takes over.
Yeah, right.
Becomes the next Prime Minister of the UK, that we try and restore some kind of order, and that people believe, okay, our systems are working, and we get to vote every number of years, and we can have sort of trust in the way political system is working.
Well, Raf, thank you so much for your insight. It's always fantastic to have you on. Enjoy your day in Christchurch. And where are you speaking tonight, just for people who might be interested?
Yes, I'm at Bishopdale Library at 7 o'clock. So if you're around, you want to come down and have a chat, then come down and join us.
Well, attempt to stay dry today. Thank you so much, Raf. Have a great day.
Okay. Thanks, Liam. Take care. See you.
And that was the wonderful insight of one Raf Manji, former city councillor, currently the leader of the Opportunities Party.